From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, May the 6th, I believe it is, 2020, and wish you all a good morning. We're going to have a good program on for you today. Xander Landon of etdigger.org is going to be talking to us first off about the state's finances. The state has taken some big financial hits from COVID-19 epidemic and response, etc. In the second half hour, we're going to be hearing from Pat Moulton, who is president of Vermont Technical College. She is going to be talking to us about that big controversy that erupted a couple of weeks ago, in which the college and the NVU campuses in Linden and Johnson were being threatened with closure. And then in the latter hour, we're going to visit with a panel of people, Christine Senecal, the chair of the Vermont Women's Commission, Christine is her middle name. There we go. Lisa Senecal is going to be one of our guests, along with Kevin Ellis and Guy Page. We're all going to be talking about the allegations against Joe Biden, former Vice President Joe Biden, presidential candidate Joe Biden, about his alleged sexual assault of a Senate staffer back in 1993. And so we'll be talking about that. Does that sink his candidacy? Should it sink his candidacy? What should the Democrats do? And so on and so forth. So we'll get into that in the second hour of the program today. But first, let's go to Xander Landon, who I believe is on the telephone with us this morning. He's with VTDigger.org, and he's been writing some stories recently about the state's troubling financial situation. Good morning, Xander.
Good morning, Dave.
And one headline that grabbed my attention that I think also had your byline on the story was concerned an estimate that there's a $200 million gap that the state now needs to fill. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So, you know, it's not surprising that the COVID-19 crisis is sort of roiling the state's finances. You know, there are so many different economic impacts that the state is seeing and that states across the country are seeing from this pandemic. And one of those is that we're just, you know, not seeing the tax revenues that we had anticipated we would bring in before all of this happened. So in the current fiscal year, which ends in July, so in, you know, a couple of months, you know, within the 3 months that, you know, COVID will have happened in this current fiscal year between March and July, 3 or 4 months, we're expected to lose about $50 million in tax revenue in the general fund, which is sort of the fund that funds a lot of the state programs, agencies, departments, basically, you know, almost all of them. Doesn't fund things like education, but a lot of government spending happens in the general fund. We're losing $50 million. Plus, there's a lot of tax revenue that the federal government and that the state government has said, you know, because of the economic hardship people are facing, people don't have to pay this year until July 15th. So that's into the next fiscal year, where basically the government's saying, all right, because we want to give people a break, you don't have to pay your income tax, you don't have to pay your meals and rooms tax if you're a business, a restaurant, until next year. So we're basically seeing a $200 million hole. And there are a few different ways that the state is saying, or that the governor is proposing, to fill that hole so that we have a balanced budget. The biggest, you know, source of funding is we're going to be dipping into reserves. About $138 million is going to be used up in our reserves. And then a lot of money that had been sort of given to by the federal government to the state for Medicaid use is also being used to cover this sort of gap in the budget. And then there are some other interesting things that have happened that have resulted in additional tax revenue that we weren't expecting. I thought one of the most interesting is that our alcohol taxes that we've gotten from alcohol sales have skyrocketed in the last few months, you know, largely because of this crisis. And we saw $5 million or so in alcohol tax revenue that we had not anticipated. So sort of putting all these things together, you get a sort of way to cover the gap in the budget without really making any major cuts. But because revenues are supposed to fall even further next year into the next fiscal year, that's when we're going to see some probably major cuts happening at the state level.
Yeah, it's a tough situation all the way around, and I just wonder, in terms of the education fund, which gets a lot of its revenue from, say, the sales tax, and also I think it gets money from the rooms and meals tax, if I recall. Both of those things obviously severely depressed in the past couple of months because businesses have been shut down and restaurants have been shut down.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the education fund is likely to see, I think it's somewhere in the current fiscal year, they're dealing with something like $50 million in revenue losses, plus additional money that's been deferred, like I said, because tax deadlines have been pushed. So that's a separate issue that's being dealt with by the administration and lawmakers. They're trying to figure out a way to, you know, help fill that gap so that it doesn't just result in, basically it's really too late to do anything like raise property taxes to fill that gap even. So they have to basically fill the hole to have a balanced budget. They're looking at doing things like, you know, allowing towns to borrow. And in the next fiscal year, the latest estimate was something in the realm of, you know, if the revenue projections are as bad as they're looking for the next fiscal year, which starts in July, and lawmakers and the governor did nothing to sort of shield, sort of taxpayers from the drop in the revenue, that property taxes would have to go up somewhere in the realm of $150 million in order to fill the gap of the revenue loss and also to fill the reserves, which would be depleted. So basically, there's a very tall task ahead for policymakers to figure out how to continue to fill these revenue gaps. And the Ed Fund is another huge problem.
Yeah, it's going to be a giant headache, and of course, I think a lot of people are worried about the impact on local property taxes going forward because whatever the Ed Fund doesn't manage to raise or doesn't have, the school expenses continue, and if we're going to pay our teachers and keep the lights on and keep the buildings heated, keep the kids in their seats, assuming they ever get back to the school buildings. Which of course is expected. We'll have a giant hole there. It's going to be going to be quite challenging. My guest is Xander Landon. He is a reporter with VTDigger.org, and he has been covering state budget issues for that organization lately. And Xander, if you have any questions or comments you'd like Xander to hear, feel free to call us up. We are 244-1777. Is the local Waterbury number. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM welcomes calls from our listeners out there. What do you folks out there think that the state government ought to be thinking about or planning for in the face of this situation in which many of our tax revenues are way down, expenses have gotten, there are new expenses that were not expected, of course. I was talking with Senator Tim Ash yesterday. He is the president pro tem of the Vermont Senate, of course, and he was saying that he thinks that the legislature will probably pass a sort of stopgap budget for about 3 months and then maybe reconvene in about August or so and start to look at a budget for the balance of the fiscal year. And I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the continuing resolutions that are famous mm-hmm. in Congress when they don't get to a budget agreement by the end of the fiscal year at the federal level. And do you think that there is widespread support for that kind of an approach in the legislature?
Yeah. And I think that they're taking that approach because the sort of fiscal analysis and revenue projections that they're dealing with are so unstable. I mean, think about how, you know, this pandemic, you know, spiked suddenly in March and, you know, within a couple of weeks just utterly changed the fiscal landscape for the federal government and state governments. I mean, we don't know how this pandemic is going to progress. We could have a better idea as to what extent we're going to see flare-ups of the virus in the fall, and you know, what the sort of, as you know, as the fiscal analysts are looking at this, they're not so much looking at sort of, and they're really focusing on these sort of epidemiological projections as much as they are looking at sort of the economic sort of landscape, because the sort of arc of the virus and its sort of trajectory are what is sort of single-handedly determining the financial conditions that and the revenue sort of landscape that the state has. So, you know, basically they're doing that so that there is a measure that will fund state government in the new fiscal year, but that there's still some flexibility to make changes according to, you know, the new projections that are coming out. So I do think that there will be support for a partial spending bill that gets us through the first 3 months and then coming back to do another budget bill. But, you know, the result of that is that, you know, lawmakers are going to be working, obviously, a lot longer than they normally would. There's also talk about, you know, putting measures in place now to address COVID if it comes back in a big way after lawmakers adjourn. So basically having in place emergency measures that could be triggered at a certain point, even if lawmakers aren't in Montpelier, or, well, I guess no one's in Montpelier anymore, but even if lawmakers aren't actively working to pass legislation, having something that could kick in, you know, in November or December that would do things like, you know, loosen the, you know, medical regulations as they are right now, or, you know, trigger things like unemployment related policies that would help people if there's another spike of, you know, layoffs or economic conditions that result in people losing their jobs.
Yeah. I wanted to circle back for a moment to something you said a few minutes ago about the alcohol revenues being up $5 million. Do you know sort of what the backdrop is there? What is the typical annual take? In other words, how big a piece of this picture is $5 million?
That's a very good question, and I do not know the answer to that. I would be curious to know. The only thing I know is that it was basically $5 million more than we had expected to receive.
Yeah, and I mean, that obviously raises some other questions, which I don't know we can get the answers to here, but I think it's worth sort of putting them up in the air and seeing maybe even some listeners out there might have some thoughts they'd like to share with us on the telephone, calling in at 244-1777 or toll-free 1-877-291-8255 to get on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV. One of the things that I wanted to ask about that, I mean, I sort of hear anecdotally that people are drinking more in part because they are they're home more. They're not they aren't planning on driving anywhere, and so they sort of feel like there's a little bit less. Less restriction there, I guess. I don't know. And then the other aspect of this is I was talking to a friend who said that he thinks the reason that it looks like liquor sales are up significantly in Vermont and in other states right now is that when people go out to the liquor store, they tend to stock up because they don't know when, you know, if the store might be closing, or they don't know when when they're going to get back to running this kind of an errand. You know, so people tend to buy, you know, two or three bottles of when they used to only buy one on this particular what was a weekly errand maybe, and is now who knows how often errand. I don't know whether any of that comes into play, or whether the substance abuse counselors out there are really worried about is people getting drunk every night. What do you have any sense of that?
Well, I don't know about, you know, I think there's obviously a lot of talk about and concern about, you know, to what extent is this going to have mental health implications? You know, people are obviously stuck inside, you know, there's been a lot of concern about, you know, seeing a spike in domestic violence incidents. Some concern I've heard about you know, potentially a spike in suicide rates. I haven't really looked into the data to see to what extent that is borne out. There's certainly concerns across the country about that. Another thing I would add, just looking at the economic sort of, you know, why have we seen, you know, an increase in revenues from this that I, you know, I don't know the answer to, but I sort of am interested in is, you know, before this or as this crisis set in, the governor pretty quickly changed regulations so that restaurants can now, you know, certain bars potentially could now serve to-go alcohol, you know, drinks. So, you know, if you go to the restaurant, you can basically get a margarita to go, which before was, you know, illegal. Restaurants couldn't do that.
Right.
And now in the sort of the wake of this crisis, we've changed regulations. So I'd be interested to know to what extent people are using that, you know, newly available service that the governor here and elsewhere, there are other governors that have done the same thing, you know, have sort of allowed to happen. And also, you know, to what extent people are, you know, using another thing that was sort of changed was the ability for like liquor stores to deliver alcohol. So, you know, to what extent is that happening versus people sort of just going and buying bulk, which I'm sure is also happening.
Yeah, that's kind of a fascinating subtext of this entire COVID-19 story, really, that has obviously just gripped the state and gripped the nation for the past 3 or 4 months now. It's it really is pretty remarkable when you think about all of the different kind of ramifications here. One of the things that is you know, you probably didn't think of first off when you thought about this crisis coming and how the government was going to respond. Medicaid apparently has spent a lot less money in the first part of this calendar year, in part because all the hospitals have put their elective procedures on hold. So no one is going to get these procedures, and therefore no one is billing Medicaid for them. And Medicaid all of a sudden has some excess revenues, which have become a factor in these budget deliberations as well.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's probably both the fact that, you know, you simply can't get, you know, an elective procedure done, although that's quickly sort of was recently changed. The governor this week did say that, you know, soon he would allow hospitals to resume some elective procedures because they are, you know, really struggling in this time without that source of revenue. But I also think it's, you know, because people are concerned about their health, they're going to be, you know, less like, you know, in contracting the virus, they're going to be less likely to see a doctor in person, get something checked out, go to the dentist. I mean, dentists can't even work right now. So there's just going to be a lot less billing going on and use of Medicaid dollars. And we saw that, you know, this week with, you know, part of the budget adjustment, including, you know, close to somewhere in the realm of, you know, $10 million in state Medicaid funds that just had been expected to be sent out the door but hadn't been because of this.
And these are, as you say, these are state dollars. Now, normally in the normal operations of Medicaid, my recollection is it's something like a 60-40 split when a Medicaid patient goes to the doctor. The federal government basically covers 60% of that. The state, you typically about 40% of that. The dollars we're talking about here are just the state dollars. So I suppose the federal government must be saving a lot of money on Medicaid right now as well.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. And another, you know, the one of the COVID federal bills that was signed back in March gave us an increased match rate from the feds. So the feds, I think it's something like $40 million in additional funding that they provided that we're using now to cover the budget gap as well. So there's a lot of Medicaid money kind of floating around right now because of this, which has been helpful in the short term.
Yeah.
Another thing I would sort of mention in the context of all these budgetary decisions that are being made is that we also have been given the largest federal grant that we've received in our history, you know, $1.25 billion that we can use to cover the costs associated with COVID-19. And that on its face sounds really great, because $1.25 billion, something in the neighborhood of, you know, a third of the state dollars that we spend each year on our state budget. So we have this huge pile of money that can be used, but there are some strings attached and there are some restrictions. And one of the biggest restrictions right now on the money is that we can't use it to fill budget gaps and revenue gaps. And so lawmakers are kind of frustrated because they're seeing, and you know, and the administration, because they're seeing huge revenue gaps that are being incurred because of a lack of economic activity, et cetera. But they can't use that money to balance the budget at this point.
All right, we have a caller on the line. I lost track of the name, but who's calling in, please? Fred from Newbury, I believe.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Okay, this is interesting. Let's see here. The property tax and the school tax is a volunteer tax. When I say volunteer tax, what I mean is you actually write a check out for each tax and set it in. Now, the big question is, what are people going to do when they don't have any money? Are they going to volunteer to pay their taxes, or are they going to buy groceries, pay the rent? What do you think?
I think that you're raising some very interesting questions there. Obviously, this is crunch time in a lot of households in Vermont. Fred Zander, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a good question, because at the end of the day, a lot of towns right now are thinking about giving taxpayers at the local level a break or an extension on paying their taxes. Not all towns will do this, but some towns are going to move to push property tax deadlines because of this crisis, and the legislature just gave them some flexibility to do that. The problem is that for municipalities, even if, you know, taxpayers can't afford to pay the taxes, even if taxpayers don't give them enough money to pay for, you know, to pay the statewide education tax, at the end of the day, if the municipalities don't give the state enough money to make up what they owe for K through 12 education in a given year, the municipality has to make the difference up. So this has been sort of cited as a huge potential problem for municipalities, because at the end of the day, no matter what happens, whether they give people abatements, whether they're aware of the fact that the taxpayers at the local level can't afford property taxes in a given pay period or a given year, they still have to make up the difference. And that's brought into this, you know, conversation a huge question about, you know, do we let them, does the state borrow on behalf of municipalities so that we have a whole, you know, an ed fund that's made whole? Do we waive penalties so that towns don't have to, you know, pay a huge, you know, increase on, you know, what they owe the state and can't pay at a given time? So this is a big problem that lawmakers are trying to work out right now.
Lots of uncertainty. Time for one more call, I believe. Steve from Essex. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Dave. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, I was just wondering if the numbers that have been cited include unemployment insurance. There's the employers are not supposed to have been held liable for unemployment due to the COVID layoffs. And I'm an employer. I just received a liability statement that said I owe about $30,000 for the first 2 weeks.
Yikes.
And
we only have a minute or so to go. Let me jump and talk to Xander about this. Xander, what do you know about the unemployment insurance and the liabilities on employers?
My understanding was that employers are not supposed to be held liable or dinged to any extent for any layoffs that are sort of tied to economic hardship or the realities of the COVID-19 crisis. So I do find that interesting. I'm not sure you're the specifics of the situation, but my understanding was that that is you know, in general, not something that's supposed to happen at this point.
Got it. Huh. Okay. Steve, thanks for the call. Good question. We are rapidly running out of time here on the bottom of, toward the bottom of the hour break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. Xander Landon of ETDigger.org has been my guest. And Xander, I thank you so much for joining me this morning and shedding some light on these state budget issues. And it's always good talking with you.
Thanks, Dave.
Alrighty. Hey, we are heading into the bottom of our break for some CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors. Before we go there, I just want to remind you about our podcast. Don't forget, if you missed some of that conversation and said, oh darn, I should have tuned in earlier, you can always go later to WDEV.com. I'm sorry. WDEV Radio. There we go. WDEVradio.com. And follow the link from that homepage to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit. You'll come up with a list of our recent programs by topic and by guest. And you can listen to your heart's content any time of day or night. Back in a couple, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
A little programming note for you. It's Wednesday, meaning we'll have the second of this week's three news conferences with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials talking about the COVID-19 crisis and the state's response to that crisis. And the WDEV has been broadcasting live all of these news conferences, typically happening in recent weeks, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Today is Wednesday, and so a little bit after the, right after the 11 o'clock news that we get from CBS, we'll be going live to Governor Phil Scott's news conference and the COVID-19 update. So don't touch that dial. Just stay right with WDEV, and you will get the latest from the governor and his people on the COVID-19 situation here in Vermont. Let's bring in our next guest. Oh, okay, not yet, I'm told. Well, we're expecting a phone call at any moment from Pat Moulton, the president of Vermont Technical College in the main campus there in Randolph was earmarked for closure in a proposal launched a couple of weeks ago. It's hard to believe it's only been a couple of weeks. By now former Chancellor Jeb Spaulding, and the state colleges went into a real paroxysm, shall we say, and we'll hear some about the VTC version of those events from Pat Moulton, who I understand is now on the phone. And good morning, President Moulton. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Dave. Thank you so much for having me.
And so I wanted to check in with you to find out sort of where to from here. I mean, obviously that must have felt like a close one a couple of weeks ago when you saw this announcement come down from then Chancellor Jeb Spaulding about the need to close the main campus of Vermont Tech and these two Northern Vermont University campuses.
Well, yeah, that was obviously not welcome news, but not new news. We'd been working on securing the future of the Vermont State Colleges since really last summer. We had plans in place to proceed with some changes here, but thought we might have 2 or 3 years to implement those changes, even though we were working immediately and have had some success immediately on changing what I'm calling our expense profile. But the COVID-19 really turned what could be 2 to 3 years into 2 to 3 months. And it really is the accelerant, the gasoline on the fire, if you will, that really accelerated where the Vermont State Colleges needs to go in terms of transforming itself and transforming ourselves here at Vermont Tech to be more sustainable in the long term. So, but, it, and I also just kind of want to make sure folks, your listeners, understand from the beginning, Vermont Tech financially is on okay ground. We have operated in the black three of the last four fiscal years, including this year, when we're anticipating still a net positive revenue, even with COVID. But, you know, that's not always been the case with us. We were not that way in 2013 when we ran a budget deficit and the system provided a loan to us, and that's what enables us to be here today. But I want your listeners to understand we're okay financially, but the system is not, and we are part of a system. We're on the same ship with all the other three institutions, so we recognize we too need to transform for long-term sustainability and to make sure that our programming is available to working adults and accessing those markets and making us more accessible to more Vermonters.
One of the things that struck me as odd about the announcement of a couple of weeks ago, it definitely put Vermont Tech in the same basket as the two NVU campuses in Linden and Johnson, and yet Vermont Tech is really significantly different from the other schools. I mean, you can fill me on the facts and figures here, but my impression has always been it has far more 2-year programs than 4-year programs, or students in those 2-year programs than in 4-year programs, and it also provides training in a variety of fields that just are not available elsewhere. I mean, I'm guessing that if you want to be, a middle school math teacher, you can get that degree, a degree supporting a career aspiration like that from Linden or from Johnson or from Castleton. But if you want to be a V-Trans highway engineer,
right?
A different story, right?
Yeah. Well, we are the only technical college in the state, and you're absolutely right. We offer a much more engineering and technology focus, computer, et cetera, education than our liberal arts sisters, which is part of what makes us unique. We also, as a result, really are able to boast things like the best return on investment for your higher education dollars of any institution, any higher ed institution in the state. We are number one for return on investment. We also rank in the top 4% nationally in terms of return on investment for higher education and technical education. That's been verified by the Georgetown University Center for Education and Workforce Development. We also boast a 99% placement rate every year. 99% of our students have a job or career when they within 6 months of graduation, and 98% of them in their field of study. So that is, and we work hard at getting the survey data done. We have a career services person who literally hounds every graduate until we get an answer, what are you doing? So we know our data is very reliable. And yes, we are unique. We provide a very applied, hands-on delivery. That's why some of this remote delivery has been a real challenge for our students who are used to being in an hour worth of lecture and then 3 hours in a lab applying what they just learned. And so it's a real challenge. And our faculty, I'm so impressed at the way they've stepped up and found innovative ways to get that applied, that lab work done. And our largest program is our nursing program. And you're right. We have more students in 2-year programs than 4-year programs, but we have a variety of bachelor's and even a master's degree at Vermont Tech now. So we're pretty diversified in the types of degrees. We offer everything from a certificate, 1-year certificate on through to a master's degree, but the majority are in the associates and then in our bachelor's in that order in terms of percentage. And our nurses are able to do what we call a 1+1 program. They come in for a year and they can get their practical nursing degrees or certificate rather, and then they can go right to work. Or they can come back for a second year, get their associate's degree in nursing and test to be a licensed nurse, and then they can do their bachelor's degree online. And so, you know, they have chances to step in and out of the marketplace, if you will, and that's what makes it very attractive, as well as we deliver in 12 to 13 locations around the state, so we're very accessible. And it's that kind of model we want to look at for more of our programs. How can we provide more access to Vermonters and potentially have what we call low residency, where students might be doing their lecture portion at home or in some remote location, and then they're coming up here for limited days a week or limited days a month to actually get their lab portion, and therefore their room and board might be based on, you know, 2 or 3 weeks a semester, not 4 months. That really changes the expense to the student. And our faculty have really recognized it's doable now that we've been pushed to that point by COVID. So, you know, we have an opportunity here to really pivot and continue the high quality education, but make ourselves more accessible.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, in terms of the nursing program, you said that's your largest program. So let's talk about that for a moment. Do I have it right that a lot of that has shifted up to the Williston campus, or are there more nursing students still at Randolph Center campus, or how does that work?
Well, our nursing students are all over the state. They're pretty well distributed. I mean, clearly there's more demand in the Chittenden County area for nursing, and I don't know the class sizes right off the top of my head, but we do have more offerings at our Williston campus, primarily because there are more healthcare institutions in Chittenden County, not the least of which is UVM Medical Center. But also Williston is where our dental hygiene program is located, and we have a full dental clinic there. Our radiologic science program we just started last fall is located there, as well as our respiratory therapy program. And that's primarily because of the hospital affiliations. But we are going to be looking at how we could move some of those programs out to more regions, the less capital intensive. You know, we can't build a dental lab everywhere, but maybe there are opportunities to work with dentists around the state to train more hygienists. So those are all things we're going to be looking at. But our nursing students are pretty well distributed around the state, and we are in literally every hospital and almost every long-term care facility with our clinical placement for our students. And more of those facilities are coming to us to say, can you please put something together where we could educate and upskill their current workforce as well as bring in new potential nurses. And so we're doing a lot of what I refer to as sort of customized, but they're specific cohorts with, you know, entities like Genesis is one we're working on and others. But and that's, I think, part of why it's our largest program is because it is accessible. Our next largest programs are our engineering and computer software programs. So, and our computer information, I'll put them more generally there. So, I mean, those are what Vermont Tech is really known for: our allied health, our engineering, our computer information, and obviously we've got a long history in agriculture. But you know, that's unfortunately been dwindling in its enrollment. But otherwise, you know, in all these programs, we're putting out great graduates, and they're getting great jobs, and they are leading the state in so many places too.
Just one more question about nursing. Now, I do want to move on to some of these other programs, but in the nursing program, one guess I would have as to why one contributing factor to it being your largest program would be that it gets a lot of support from from the institutions out there. Some of the hospitals in Vermont, I understand, will pay people to go back to school to sort of notch up from being, you know, a licensed practical nurse to a registered nurse, or up from being a licensed nursing assistant to a L, you know, there's this.
Yeah,
there's
LNA LPN to LPN RN to
and
BSN.
So there's a pipeline there that you can get significant financial support from hospitals in Vermont to take these classes, and you know, if you climb this ladder all the way to, say, the RN level, then you're making a really nice middle class living.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Hospitals are supporting their own employees and their nurses coming in with tuition reimbursement. I think that's fairly ubiquitous. I think most hospitals are doing that. And then we have a program right now with Central Vermont Medical Center that we and CCV are doing, where they're taking either administrative assistants or LNAs or others that are in the hospital that want to become nurses, and we're actually teaching that on-site at CVMC. They're paying release time for their employees to take this program, and they're covering the cost of it, in part because they need the nurses, and we are able to be flexible and deliver that on their site and use their skills labs and simulation labs and things of that nature. And even their staff often are acting as faculty teaching our curriculum. So those are innovative models, and we can look at different types of models for different situations. But yeah, there's no question there's a huge demand. And, you know, one of the challenges we have with nursing, frankly, is getting clinical instructors, those nurses who obtain the right and proper degree to instruct our students when they're in the clinical setting. And recently made a plea to the Board of Nursing to see a change there that might open up that. They did not approve that change, but we do see more and more hospitals trying to figure out how they can help us out by providing some of their staff who can serve in that capacity.
Yeah, that is, I know that is a challenge for institutions like yours, because, you know, as I said, a lot of nurses who've been, especially those who were experienced and, you know, who you might want to see in front of a classroom full of student nurses, are pretty well compensated out there working in the field, and it's tough to keep up, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a good career in nursing. It's hard work, but it's well paid. And in many cases, there can be some flexible scheduling. And also for Vermonters, it's a great opportunity to get a career in healthcare. And there's lots of different places you can go with it, too. I mean, we really hope some of today's nurses will decide at some point they want to teach nursing, because unfortunately, you don't make as much teaching as you do practicing, but there really is a very flexible career. And today is National Nurses Day, so a shout out to all of our nurses who are.
I knew there was a reason I was focusing on this for a while.
Right. So I have nurses in my family, but Lord knows we've got tons of nurses here at Vermont Tech, those nurses in training and nurses who are doing the educating. So thank you to all of our nurses.
Great. Yep. Well, and this idea of employers supporting education and the latter here, are other employers doing that?
Absolutely. We have a lot of partnerships with a lot of manufacturing and other firms in everything from leadership training to specific manufacturing-related apprenticeship work. We're doing right now apprenticeship work with General Electric in Rutland, GS Precision in Brattleboro, GW Plastics in Royalton and Bethel, and with GlobalFoundries. So there's a lot of manufacturers who recognize, and other companies, that they need to be part of, they need to be part of the solution in building their talent pipeline. And so they're putting their money where their mouth is and bringing us in, again, often to their facility or through distance learning. We can broadcast from here in Randolph to wherever, and we can either use their labs or their facilities as labs, or we bring students here. For example, in GE Rutland, we have students that come up here to Randolph periodically to get some of the education on our labs here. But yeah, I think more and more employers are recognizing if they want to make sure they have adequate talent that is adequately prepared, they've got to be part of the solution. And I think that's a positive trend, but particularly so before COVID, when unemployment was so low and it was a matter of really growing their own talent. And GW Plastics and Ben Reel, the CEO there, is, you know, made no bones, and he speaks publicly about the fact that, you know, but for Vermont Technical College, they probably wouldn't have seen the growth that they've seen in the last 8 to 10 years, because they are able to see a good pipeline of talent graduate from us every year. There's companies like LED Dynamics in downtown Randolph where, you know, 20% of their workforce are Vermont Tech grads. So we are literally fueling the Vermont economy with our graduates. And 85% of our students are Vermonters, and 78% on average stay in Vermont after graduation, and a number of those who don't come back. So, you know, we really are about trying to educate Vermonters for careers of the future, and especially post-COVID, where innovation and new technologies are going to be developed. Our graduates are going to be needed, because they're going to be out there providing those solutions and really helping develop new products and new systems as we respond to what life on this planet looks like post-COVID.
And do we still have Pat from Randolph on the line?
Yes.
Good morning, Pat.
Morning. I was wondering if Pat could help explain something to me. I've been listening for the last 15, 20 minutes about VTC is doing well financially. Rate on investment is best in the state and one of the best in the country. We have a 99% placement rate. We have innovative programs at VTC, and we're working with local businesses very innovatively. How was the next step after that? Well, I guess we'll close this one.
Well, thank you for the question, Pat. And it really comes back to more the campus, the physical infrastructure, than anything else. I will just say 35 to 40 years of legislative neglect in terms of appropriations to the state colleges has meant that our capital reserves are not where they should be. Our deferred maintenance is much higher than it should be. We haven't really modernized our dorms in a long time. And students expect a different residential experience. I was talking to a 1969 agricultural graduate the other day, and he said, well, you know, you didn't need a lot of frills back then, but students are expecting a little bit more on the frill side these days. So that was, I believe, the main reason, was a recognition that Vermont Tech's programs are important, but the campus is a little aged. And that's where our overhead is, and it is in our residential capacity. And the chancellor's correct notion that in today's higher education business, you don't need as much residential capacity. So our challenge is trying to reduce our overhead, because you're right, our programs are solid, our outcomes are fabulous, but we've got to reduce our expense profile. We've got to get out from under some of this overhead. And that's where the community of Randolph has been really stepping up thus far and helping us by looking at which buildings could potentially be repurposed for other activities, whether that be affordable housing or daycare or office or maker or incubator type space, because that's what's ultimately going to enable us to sustain, is to have a more nimble operating cost profile, if that helps.
All right. Hey, Pat, thank you for the call. Let's go to Sean in Hardwick.
President Moulton, good morning. This is Sean in Hardwick, and something I've been thinking about, and I don't think this is unique to your campus. I think it impacts the other state colleges that are in a bit of a tight spot right now. Is there an opportunity where we collaborate with these businesses that you're already providing employees to, where they could maybe literally shift a portion of their operations back to the campus site? Thinking about Randolph as an example, perfect distribution point, potentially buildings that are under-occupied. You got a workforce right there that can be working alongside people, and it's a way outside the box thinking strategy. But I think this most recent the pandemic issue is demonstrating we've got to do a better job of supplying domestically, and it seems like there's an opportunity here.
Thank you, Sean, for your question, and thanks for calling in. I agree, and I do think that's a way we can be looking going forward. If you look at some of what other colleges and universities around the country and even the globe have been doing, it is that economic development partnership with business and really providing direct, whether it be talent, but also potential to operate on the campus and use students as even part of the workforce while they're here, be they interns or nights and weekends, things of that nature. And that could go for literally any type of business. So that would be part of the repurposing of the buildings, is looking at could we offer those kinds of opportunities. And you're right, Randolph Center is a geographic center of Vermont, excellent distribution. We have a lot of land here that we could potentially look at for redevelopment. So that is absolutely on the table, and I thank you for bringing that up.
Two excellent questions from listeners to wrap up this segment here. Pat Moulton has been my guest. She is the president of Vermont Technical College. And, Pat, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's my pleasure, David. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's talk soon. Let's go to a top-of-the-hour break on the Dave Graham Show for some CBS News, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks.
Thank you. A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back. Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this Wednesday morning, May the 6th, 2020. And we're going to be talking, I think, in a couple of moments with Stephen Portnoy of CBS News. We like to go to one of our national correspondents after the mid-show break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And really appreciate CBS being willing to provide their correspondents from time to time to get on the phone with us and tell us what the national picture is looking like out there. I've got some questions for Stephen Portnoy about the announcement from the White House yesterday that maybe it wasn't an announcement, but a story that came out of the White House anyway, indicating that there may be a horizon for the White House Coronavirus Task Force. I believe Stephen Portnoy is now on the phone with us, and good morning.
Hey, good morning to you.
And tell me a little bit about this news that came out yesterday indicating that the Coronavirus Task Force at the White House possibly could be disbanded in the near future.
Well, it's been, I don't want to say contradicted, because I guess that might be casting it in the wrong light, but it's been changed by the president himself. Despite having said last night that he would organize a new panel, one focused on reopening the country safely, he says in a tweet about an hour ago that the work of the task force will continue on indefinitely. Now this is yes. So that's the new news this morning as of an hour ago. He's no longer disbanding the task force. What he did tell us last night, what the vice president told us yesterday, was that the work of the task force would be wound down, probably around Memorial Day or the first week of June. The vice president envisioned sending the experts on the panel back to their agencies to have a more traditional response to the crisis. But now the president, having apparently felt that the news coverage of this was not favorable, has decided to reverse course. He says that the work will continue on indefinitely with a new focus. The task force will be focused, in addition to vaccines and therapeutics and testing, on reopening the economy. And he says that some members of the task force may be added, others may be subtracted. But you might be wondering why this matters, right? Because the federal government has been doing what it's been doing under the leadership of the president and the vice president. The task force has been convening every day, oftentimes in the Situation Room, briefing the top leaders, discussing amongst themselves, debating amongst themselves whether to implement guidelines with respect to social distancing and face covering and varying reopening suggestions. And that has been the primary mode through which the federal government has been not only deciding things, but also communicating to the American people. And the idea of disbanding it, sending all of these officials back to their respective agencies and not having a coordinated effort through the White House, I think led some experts to be concerned. And now the president, having seen that concern, says that instead what he's going to do is essentially morph the current task force into something that he feels is perhaps just as important as working on testing and vaccines and therapeutics, and that is reopening the economy. Now, one thing was revelatory yesterday, revealing, in the president's interview with ABC News, in which he essentially said that, he believes that, yes, people may succumb to the coronavirus if the country is reopened. But he says that he does not believe the models, which have been out of whack, he says, from the beginning. And he says that we have to get the country reopened. This week, there were models forecasting as many as 3,000 deaths per day. And a total of 135,000 deaths between by August. And as of this morning, the death toll from coronavirus is already upwards of 70,000 in the United States. The president, who had said that there would be zero then said maybe 50,000, maybe 60,000, maybe 65,000, is now saying perhaps 100,000 deaths. He yesterday reflected on the fact that you have, in his words, a Yankee Stadium full of death. He says it affects him deeply, powerfully, that he loses sleep at night over it. He even went so far as to say that no one has been affected by it more than him.
I guess the president is, well, let me just go back to, for a moment, to the confusion around the disbanding or not disbanding of this task force, because I noticed there was a news report, sort of a corollary news report yesterday, indicating that Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, had not been told, because he said he had heard not heard about this proposal get rid of it. Do you think there was a conversation in which he went into the president and said, hey, you can't disband this thing. We've got a lot of work to do.
I'm not aware of any specific conversation that may have taken place between Dr. Fauci and the president, but I can tell you Dr. Fauci did have a conversation with my colleague Paula Reed yesterday. At the same time, the Vice President Pence was telling reporters at the old executive office building that that work would be wound down, that he wanted to see the agency heads go back to their agencies and have a more traditional response to all this. Dr. Fauci was on the phone with my colleague Paula Reed, and Paula was asking Dr. Fauci about these reports that were emerging, first in the New York Times and others on the news wires, because the vice president was telling a small group of about 11 reporters his plan in a closed-door meeting, and the word was starting to get out. And Dr. Fauci said he had not heard any of this, that he had just been at a task meeting yesterday morning, and that was not the plan, that the reports weren't true. Now, that's an emblem of the president and vice president having their own vision and communicating it to the press before communicating it to a key member of the task force. And then you have the president speaking on his own last night in Arizona about his desire to have a new panel formed. And now this morning he's reversing course. This is a microcosm, or one typical example we've all experienced over the last 3.5 years of how this president conducts the foreign government, federal government. He telegraphs through his own words and tweets how he wants things to go. It often contradicts prepared plans. But, you know, one thing we've learned over the course of the Trump presidency is that it really is the decisions of one man as to how this is all going to play out. That's different from what we've seen in the past, at least in the recent past, where presidents – everything, the decision is already made, and while the president is the decider, it's very, very, you know, traditional, and these things are, you know, there's a groupthink kind of sort of notion of how the White House works. In this case, there was even some distance, it seems, between the vice president and the president as to how this is going to go. I mean, the vice president was talking about having the agencies perform the work in a traditional way. The president this morning says no, the task force will continue to convene, the work will continue on indefinitely, which means that the vice president's design of having the agency heads go back to their agencies is no longer what's going to happen.
The president essentially, if I understand this correctly, and this is a little bit of circling back, but I wanted to revisit this point because it's so important. The president essentially said, from what I understand, that yes, we may have some additional deaths, but it's vitally important that we get the economy moving again. Is that a fair interpretation?
I think, well, look, in the context of the question he was asked last night on television was, do you understand the fact that as the country is reopening, and I'm paraphrasing the question, do you understand the fact that the country is going to reopen means that there will be more people dying? That's what the experts are suggesting. And the president said, yes, there may be some, which has been taken to mean that the president acknowledges that that's inevitable. At the same point, he does question the models. He says, as I mentioned, that they've been out of whack from the beginning. They continue to adjust. Well, the reason they do is because what you can't predict is human behavior in uncharted territory that we're in right now. You know, when you tell people to shut down their businesses and schools and stay in their homes, well, you know, there's only one place where we can predictably assume that they're going to follow those instructions without pushing back, and that's China. Here in the United States, you know, there are guidelines and there's advice, and perhaps in the states there are orders, but then you see these things, you know, they ebb and they flow, and the governors are responding to push back in their respective states, and things are changing rapidly. So for the modelers, they have to figure out, well, okay, if people emerge from their homes to this extent, what's the likelihood, based on the mathematics, that the virus will spread from one person to many others. And it really is hard. And based on how many people who might get the virus, how many of them will die. That's why the models keep changing, because human behavior keeps changing.
Yeah, it's tough. It is tough to establish a static picture, for sure. That is not going to be happening. Hey, I really appreciate you joining me this morning, Stephen Portnoy of CBS News, and let's do this again soon.
You bet.
We're going to proceed into our next segment here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM, and we're going to be talking in this next segment with Kevin Ellis, a longtime journalist, lobbyist, blogger, all-around guy in the Montpelier scene. He was a fixture at the State House for many years. He's a board member at vtdigger.org these days, and he'll be one of our guests. Lisa Senecal is also joining us. She is chair of the Vermont Commission on Women, and frequently has some really interesting and enlightening things to say about the whole situation involving relations between the sexes and sort of how women are making progress in society or sometimes not, and et cetera. And well, we've got the two of them on, and I think we're going to try to be getting in touch with Guy Page. Wanted to bring in a sort of more conservative Republican voice here into the discussion here as well, because obviously there have been a lot of conservative Republicans commenting recently about the situation involving former vice president, current presidential candidate, likely Democratic nominee Joe Biden. Biden has been accused of essentially sexual assault by a former staff member in his Senate office. This was back in 1993, she alleges, and he did some things with her that she found to be very offensive, and I think most people would. And the senator, now presidential candidate, is being called out on this by a woman named Tara Reid. And there's a lot of question now about, is this going to be damaging to his campaign? Should it be damaging to his campaign, et cetera? We're going to be touching on all of this in the coming few minutes here on the Dave Graham Show. Let me welcome to our air Lisa Senecal, the chair of the Vermont Commission on Women. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
And I believe we have Kevin Ellis with us as well. Hello, Kevin, I believe...
Hi, Dave.
You are on the other.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Lisa.
How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm great.
That's good. So, Kevin, talk to us a little bit about sort of what the headline is here. What are the facts of this case, that, as you know them, and then we'll get into maybe what Lisa's thinking about it as well here, and get the conversation going.
Well, many years ago, in '93, according to the allegation, Joe Biden sexually assaulted Tara Reid. That's the allegation.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are, I believe, in a Senate office building. And now we are doing the dance that we do politically in this country now, weighing all of our political allegiances and our insecurities and our vulnerabilities and our histories and trying to figure out, you know, what each of us should do in this situation, whether you, who do you believe or who do you not believe. I'll leave it to Lisa to, because she's far more of an expert than I am, but I'll try to restrict myself to the politics of this. I think it's Biden and his staff have denied all the allegations. It seems that day by day, more people emerge who corroborate Reid's allegation. And so this is an enormous, this puts, as my favorite writer in the world, Rebecca Traister, says, this puts all of us in what she calls a poisonous bind. You know, if Biden is this kind of guy or was this kind of guy, and I believe in some ways that he is, just by virtue of the era in which he became a senator. If your one goal in the world is to rid the world of Donald Trump as the president, then this puts us all in a terrible political Hobson's choice.
Yeah, I leaves Democrats certainly in a tough spot. Lisa Senecal, I wonder if you can reflect on some of this and tell me, during the Kavanaugh hearings, this is, of course, Brett Kavanaugh's Senate hearing in which he was up for appointment to the Supreme Court a couple of years ago. There was a lot of discussion in the Me Too movement about how we essentially needed to believe women. And if we follow that instruction this time, then we've got to conclude that Joe Biden is a bad actor. And where does that leave us?
I think one of the difficult aspects of discussing any of these allegations has become sort of a misinterpretation of what I believe women was intended to mean, and at least how I interpret it. We used to be in a situation of, people refer to it as he said, she said, but it really never was that. It was he said, so it didn't matter what she said. And women's allegations weren't taken seriously. They were just dismissed out of hand and they weren't investigated. And my interpretation of believe women is that we need to take every allegation that's brought forward seriously, and a serious investigation needs to go into those allegations. So far, what I've seen is one of the primary differences in how the Biden accusation versus the Kavanaugh accusation has been handled is that there was not a serious investigation into the Kavanaugh, Christine Blasey Ford's allegations against Brett Kavanaugh. And there was a race to confirm in an attempt, I believe, to not have to dig any deeper into what might or might not have happened. I think the investigation has been slow into these allegations that Tara Reid has made against Joe Biden, and it should have been taken seriously faster than it has. But I hope we're going to have a very fair hearing and get all the facts out that are available.
And in what forum would that be?
Well, I think at this point it's really the press that's going to do this for us and continue to push to dig. And, you know, unfortunately, we're in such a polarized environment, and the validity of things reported by the press has really been undermined. And there's been an effort to discredit any facts that are reported that are not what one side or the other wants to believe that they are. But I'm not sure what the other forum at this point is to investigate the allegation.
Yeah, I wonder also, Kevin Ellis, the Democratic convention approaches rapidly. It's going to be midsummer. And what about the timing of all this?
Well, I don't think there's going to be an in-person Democratic convention. I know the Biden camp is preparing for that. So the politics of all this are that Trump, who has absolutely no moral or ethical standard whatsoever, will use this to beat Biden over the head with. And he will benefit, as usual, by the very weird double standard we have in this country, where Trump is credibly accused of rape, assault, and has admitted assaulting women and happy to get away with it. And yet he pays no political price. So Biden is going to get hit with this, and this happens to Democrats all the time, right? Democrats hold themselves to a higher sort of moral public standard than the Trump people, and therefore they get hoisted on their own sort of righteous self-righteousness. Whereas Trump, the voters, I think, they sort of have baked this into their calculation about Trump. We know he's a scumbag. And so we don't expect anything better from him. We roll our eyes in disgust. Whereas a guy like Biden, we expect more from him. The problem is, Biden came of age when the Senate was an old boys club, Dave, as you know, and I still have not heard a credible apology from Joe Biden to Anita Hill. Now, many of your listeners may be too young to remember that, but, you know, Biden has issued a non-apology apology to Anita Hill, and, you know, that just, you know, the list of things that Biden has done that had a negative impact on the fortunes of women in this country is long. Now, back then, nobody really cared, and that's what Lisa's talking about. Now we do, now we do care because of the bravery of people like Christine Blasey Ford, Anita Hill, and the list goes on and on. And we have a president who we don't expect better from him, but we do expect better from Biden.
Let's take a call. We, by the way, 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury. 1-877-291-8255. At 877-291-8255 is the toll-free number. Jeff in West Braintree is on the line. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. I knew you couldn't resist getting Trump tangled into this. This is your Democratic way to do things. Blame him for something. Look at Joe Biden may or may not have done this. Nobody knows. If you listen to Alan Dershowitz, guys like that, and the same thing happened during the Kavanaugh trial, the hearings. Let's get the evidence out there. Let's find out whether he did it or not before we accuse him. And you get all those senators in there during the Kavanaugh trial, like Hirono, Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren. Oh, he was guilty. We believe her. We believe her, the Blasey Ford. Well, where are these people now? They're absent. They're not even there. They're silent. But I
thanks for the call, Jeff. I got to jump, but let's go to Anita in Manchester Center.
Wow, that was something. I definitely believe Blasey Ford. She had a lot of credibility and a lot of good facts, and had the cojones to stand up there and take it in the face from Congress. I do not believe Biden's accuser, because something that the men in the audience may not understand, that's a very violent act of digital penetration, and it's a pattern of behavior. And I think that we have no other evidence that that's, is he huggy? Yes. Is he kind of overly handsy? Sure. But I think that that speaks to his generation more than his feeling of that he can get away with something like that. That's a character fault. It's not a generational fault. And when we talk about this, I don't think that Lisa will say this, but if you know what she's been through, we have a tendency to not believe. The movement is more about believing women and letting them have their say. Lisa is, she is not the typical victim. And someone felt enough in a position of power to absolutely victimize her with a sexual assault. And we have to look at the behaviors and not excuse them, not believe every woman that comes forward, because certainly there are opportunists out there. But it's good that we're having this discussion, and I'm glad that you have Lisa on this call leading it.
Well, Anita, thank you very much for the call. We got to go to a bottom-of-the-hour break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we'll be back in a few minutes. I hope that our latest caller, Joe from Bristol, can hang in there through the break. And we'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back, and we have a caller on the line. Joe from Bristol is with us. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning to your guest. A provocative show. I was just thinking that, of course, a woman, women must be believed in a case of like that. You know, you just, I don't think anyone would just do that lightly. And, of course, I think this woman has witnesses that she told at the time. Now, I don't know if she told them of a rape or whatever it was, but anyway, she should be heard. The other thing I have a question for your guest is that I don't think Donald Trump was ever accused of rape. If you do know of that, what time or by whom he was accused of rape, I think he was accused of having sex while he was married with multiple women. Of course, he was a billionaire playboy, and what, of course, that's what they do, you know, and you know, no one will deny that. And so, but I think they were paid lucratively, for non-disclosure agreements and so forth, and they agreed to have the sex. Am I incorrect?
Kevin Ellis, you use the that word, the R word. Back that up if you can.
E. Jean Carroll, a New York-based writer who last summer accused President Trump of raping her in the 1990s.
I didn't know that. What is his name?
Her name is E. Jean Carroll.
E. Jean Carroll. I'll look into that.
Yep, and she has she's sued Trump, and the lawsuit is ongoing.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that someone has, you know, done the proper judicial work to get that forward. That's really important. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Joe. A couple things before we proceed. I want to just mention at the top of the hour, once again, one of the governor's news conferences, WDEV will be in a special broadcast live, Governor Phil Scott's news conference just after the 11 o'clock news here. And you can stay tuned for the latest on the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis. Lisa Senecal, I wanted to ask you, you know, Joe was talking about just now about we need to believe women when they make allegations like this. Is there any distinction to be made between taking women seriously when they make allegations like this, but still preserving some reticence or the old standard of innocent until proven guilty or some desire to vet the charge?
Oh, absolutely. There has to be a vetting of the charge. When women come forward with allegations like this, at least up until the Me Too movement, the vast majority of the time they would be dismissed. That's not so much the case now, but we're still contending with that. And that doesn't happen when people who are victims of other types of crime come forward to report their allegations. They're believed, the allegations are vetted, and you know, the chips fall where they do, whether there is evidence to back up the allegation or not. But nobody questions you know, somebody who goes into the police department and says that my car was just broken into. That's not a suspect allegation, that there's an immediate assumption that the person might be doing it for less than honorable reasons. So, yes, we absolutely have to vet these allegations, but it's really important to remember that there is not an over-reporting of sexual harassment or sexual assault allegations. These instances are grossly under-reported, and the rate of false reports is the same for sexual assault claims that it is for any other crime that people make accusations about. The difference is when it's a sexual assault allegation, we know that these are so wildly underreported that if we look at the true incidents, there's actually a much lower incidence of false reports for sexual assault and harassment allegations.
Yeah, that is a something really worth looking at. I'm just wondering, do you have any sense, Lisa Senecal, whether the justice system has actually improved? Are there any statistical studies out there indicating that the justice system is doing a better job of taking in complaints like this and processing them in a proper way?
What I know is mostly anecdotal, and there does appear to be a greater degree of and that these allegations being taken seriously. I think more women are coming forward when something does happen to them, but it's still a very small percentage of women who do. I think that there is, I think there's more ongoing effort to train and educate people who would be receiving those reports from women, so that there's a greater sensitivity and folks who are working with a person who comes forward on a sexual assault understands better about the inconsistencies that their story. This is a victim of trauma, and trauma victims' recollections, it is not a linear thing. So I think that training is better. I think there are more resources out there for women than there were before. There are organizations, Times Up is one that comes to mind, that will help women move their claims forward through the legal system. But for the vast majority of women that this happens to, they don't have the resources or the ability to safely report. And that's nothing that's going to change quickly. And what I think is going to change faster is the work we can do to change society versus, you know, whether or not our criminal justice system is ever going to provide the resources that women need.
Hmm. Well, of course, the criminal justice system is an important part of society, and you kind of hope and that people are still willing to try to push it to change and improve. Obviously, it's imperfect in many, many respects, and is in a state of needing improvement. And I hope that folks will continue to work in that realm toward improving the justice system, both in its ability to take in and really give serious consideration to these kinds of complaints, and also in its in many other respects. Heaven knows the justice system is sometimes gets it wrong, and you think about these projects that have exonerated people after years and years in prison and so on and so forth. They're very imperfect, but the work continues to try to improve it. Anyway, I wanted to say a couple of other things. One is that we're trying to bring in Guy Page on the program here. He is a conservative and somebody who defends President Trump pretty routinely, and wanted to get him on our air. But before we do that, I wanted to bring in a caller who's Chris from Waterbury. Let's go to Chris. Good morning. Chris, are you there? Oh, okay. And have we been able to reconnect with Guy Page? Okay. Well, that's two strikes. Mike from Middlesex, let's go there.
Yeah.
Vic, I'm sorry. Vic from Middlesex, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening, and, you know, there's a back and forth to your listeners and one of your guests there, I can't recall his name, but, you know, about that, putting political on this connotation. But the bottom line is, and Lisa could probably correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read that somewhere in the 90-95% of all women will sometime be they'll be in presence of sexually allegations that they are unwanted sexual advances, not necessarily assaults, but the assaults can be down to maybe like 75 or 80% of all women, and this is just crazy. Can you imagine walking around thinking this is going to happen to you? I mean, is that correct, Lisa? That the percentages are that high?
The percentages of sexual assault are not 90-95%, but certainly women who have been faced with unwanted sexual comments, sexual aggression, sexual harassment, street harassment. It's difficult to find a woman who will tell you that something along the spectrum has not happened to her and probably happened to her a whole lot more than one time. in her life. And you ask, you know, can you imagine what it's like to walk around and expect that that sort of thing is going to happen to you? That's how women go through the world. We need to anticipate that this sort of thing could happen. It's part of the way that we keep ourselves safe.
Can I say one thing?
One more thing.
It's, we have to do a better job, because every day in even in government and wherever we go, we can see this. People wearing T-shirts that have not so good comments on them, all kinds of things. And our politicians are not sticking up for women in that. They're just not taking it seriously, and we're not. We're not taking it seriously, and we should be.
Interesting point, Vic. Thanks for the call, Lisa Seneca. What do you think? Should politicians actually be more outspoken about this stuff? And I mean, it seems to only come up in the political realm these days when somebody's accused.
One of the things that I think we could do that would dramatically move forward the conversations would be if we elected more women and more women ran for office. It would not be a conversation that we needed to work hard to make sure was happening. It would be integrated into the overall conversation that people are having. We're certainly not doing enough. It shouldn't just be when there's an allegation that comes up. But I do think there are a lot of politicians now who are working hard to have the conversations more frequently, to pass legislation that will help women. But no, it's not happening quickly enough. And, you know, when we end up in a situation where we have someone who is accused of sexual assault by one woman and touching made them feel uncomfortable by a number of women. And on the other hand, we have Donald Trump, who's been credibly accused of sexual assault, harassment, rape by at least 23 women at this point. It's going to generate conversation around the issue, but it also creates an incredibly uncomfortable situation for women who are going to be voting in 2020, and also for, you know, not just women, but people who are concerned about this issue. Now, I don't think it's remotely apples to apples between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and I will absolutely cast a vote for Joe Biden in November, but I won't say that he was my first choice in the primary, but there's no contest in the general.
The one distinction here that I think is worth pointing out as well is that Donald Trump on a couple of occasions has admitted to things that really are frankly quite questionable behaviors in terms of approaching women and the whole topic of sexual behavior and so on. In one instance, of course, is the famous Access Hollywood tape, where, you know, you have this guy on tape who is talking about what is essentially sounds like pretty assaultive behavior. That's one instance. Another troubling incident was when he was interviewed years ago by Howard Stern, the radio host, and told him that Trump told Stern that Trump had gone into the dressing room of some underage beauty contestants. And he said he was okay doing that because he owned the pageant, I think was the phrase. And to me, that's just a real example of somebody abusing his privilege, and in this case, the privilege of being wealthy enough to own a beauty pageant, I guess, and thinking that therefore that entitles him to behave in this way. And so these are public, in the case of the Howard Stern interview, certainly a public admission. The Access Hollywood tape, clear that Trump knew he was being recorded when he was talking, but they got him on tape talking about this stuff, and the fact that you have somebody who has made these admissions, I think is just, that's way beyond certainly anything Joe Biden has done, to my knowledge, And you have to look at that as some sort of, I don't know, self-incrimination, don't you? Kevin Ellis, what do you think about that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well,
Kevin, let me ask you that.
You want Kevin?
Yeah.
Well, David, add the fact that Trump palled around with Jeffrey Epstein for years in New York, and there's there's video evidence of that, saying disgusting things to women. And I would just go back to this weird dichotomy we have in this country, where I think we kind of, certainly Trump supporters, from Mitch McConnell on down, accept this behavior because it is baked into the calculation. We expect this from Trump. We know who he is. We've read about him, his career on TV and in real estate. And all of this is just sort of normal for him. And so in a perverse kind of way, it is excused by voters, whereas we expect higher behavior, higher standard of behavior for guys like Joe Biden. And that's as far as I can go in actually explaining this very weird phenomenon, but it exists.
Let's go to a caller. We have Candy from Morgan is checking in. Good morning, Candy.
Hi there. Thank you for having this program. I think it's not only obviously timely, but I think we have to keep talking about these things. So I'm grateful that you're having it. and I certainly appreciate Lisa's perspective. I'm a 67-year-old educated professional woman, and like every woman, virtually every woman I know, something has happened to her somewhere along the spectrum between inappropriate to illegal or immoral or grotesquely inappropriate, somewhere along that spectrum. Cutting it off as assault, and this is sort of obviously a different allegation. But in our day, we didn't talk about it. Women among ourselves, it was the culture. We didn't talk about it. So I think that the allegations against Biden, it's yet to be vetted. I so appreciate hearing Lisa say that, of course, the allegations have to be looked at. When we say we need to believe women, that doesn't mean there isn't due process here. So I'm really grateful to hear that. I think the other thing I'd be interested to hear what folks have to say is there's also a reason we have statute of limitations on many crimes, because we're now, whether it's Brett Kavanaugh or Joe Biden, we're talking about something that is alleged to have happened 30 years ago. And these are tough issues, even when they're current. And something that is alleged to have happened 30 years ago, it's just going to be, I think, tough to get to the bottom of it.
That's a really interesting point, Candy. Thank you for the call. I guess I'll ask you, Lisa Senecal, your thoughts in terms of the statute of limitations issue or whatever. Does it change at all when the allegations date from a time when the alleged perpetrator was in high school, as in the case of Kavanaugh, and or was in the U.S. Senate, as in the case of Joe Biden?
The statute of limitations issue is really tough. I do think when you don't have a statute of limitations, trying to get to the bottom of what happened 30 years ago is incredibly difficult. However, we know, especially in previous generations, coming forward with these allegations would probably mean the end of your career. They were not going to be taken seriously. And in serious allegations or in allegations of violent sexual assaults, and even offenses to a lesser degree, it's created trauma for the victim. And coming forward quickly to share a trauma, especially one that is as physically intimate and difficult to talk about as a sexual assault, I think we have to give, I think we give a very long statute of limitations if we're going to have one at all. because we just don't know how individual survivors are going to respond.
Let me go to Guy Page, who I understand is back with us now. Guy, good morning. Thanks for joining us. And I wanted to ask you that same question. Let's roll the clock back 30 years, let's or 27 years or whatever. Imagine it's a you're not just legally, but sort of morally and ethically, and you're thinking about a statute of limitations and whether a very old allegation is what kind of weight it gets or whether it gets discounted at all from its age. And the question I really want to get to is, go to the place in life where the alleged perpetrator is. In Kavanaugh's case, he's in high school, or I guess there was another case of rather rude behavior in college. But in both cases, I think less than 20. In the case of Joe Biden in 1993, Biden, of course, was already, I haven't done the math, but I'm guessing at least in his 50s or so. He's a United States senator, different from a high school or college kid in his current sort of place in life and so on. Does that make a difference?
I think the more mature and established someone is, sure. I think it does make a difference. I think Kevin Ellis said it right at the very top of the show here. Said, let's this dance you do. And it's obviously political. It's all about who we want to be president. And you know what? People, let's just stop dancing. Let's just say my guy is 10 times the potential president and leader of this country than your guy. And they both have, shall we say, accusations, checkered past, call it what you will. But who's going to do the best job? Who's going to, after this pandemic, who's really going to make America great again? Who's the best one? And because I think we're all kind of tired of this sort of weaponization of sexual assault. And it is sort of funny to hear that some of the same people, including maybe even some individuals on this show, who were telling me, well, there must be something wrong with you, morally wrong with you, if you support Donald Trump. And that was a difficult thing to hear. But I really think what it comes down to is you have to live with your own conscience and think, who's the best leader of this country going to be?
And Lisa Senecal, do you think that there is too much politics being made out of this stuff? I mean, or is it something we want to pursue here as a way in and of itself as the issue of sexual assault and men's privilege and that kind of thing?
I don't know how you separate credible lifelong allegations of sexual misconduct from who a person is and how they would lead. So for me, I don't know how you don't discuss the allegations that have been made both against Joe Biden and Donald Trump. It says something about who you are, and I think we need to.
I wish, Lisa, I got to interrupt here. I wish we had another hour to talk about this, but we don't. I got to say thank you and goodbye to my guests, so Lisa Senecal, chair of the Vermont Commission on Women, Kevin Ellis, Guy Page, and the callers. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for listening, folks. Have a good afternoon. Stay healthy, and we'll talk again tomorrow.